Judge Cohen set a very high standard for these panels, and the panelists did a wonderful job in bringing out some important issues, sparked a lot of thought and good interaction with the participants here. And, I wanted to note to everyone that this is an open meeting, of course, and it's to inform the committee that Mark Fishman and I are chairing to help us in preparing our report. I know that there are probably important ideas that came to mind through that discussion and those that will follow. And we would very much like to hear from you in writing, if you're willing. And if you could give us information, written information by December 15th, that would be helpful to us in preparing our report in February. And these documents, if you submit them, would become a part of the public record for our study. So if you have input that you would like to provide, we would welcome it. We know there are a lot of thoughtful and good people here who have important perspectives that we ought to hear. Our next panel is going to be moderated by Margot Bagley. She is a member of our committee, of course, professor of law at the University of Virginia. And this session is to focus on effects of technology transfer and intellectual property management on the norms of the university. So, Margot, thank you very much. Margot just returned from Japan yesterday, and I think it's great she's moderating the panel. And this will keep her awake because she has to be on point. Margot?
Konnichiwa. Well, I think the topic of this panel follows quite nicely from the panel that we had first this morning. There's been a perception that efforts to increase technology transfer from the university, efforts to increase the patenting or protection of intellectual property generated in universities, has resulted in a deterioration of norms within the university that has not been positive, or perhaps in some cases there have been norm changes that have been positive. At any rate, this topic is one that the members of this panel are well qualified to discuss. As in the first panel, I'm going to give just one line introductions of each of our panelists. They will then have an opportunity to give short introductory statements dealing with the topic of this panel. Then we'll have a longer discussion about the questions that have been listed on the agenda in relation to this topic, and then an open session for Q&A from the audience. So going down the line, we've got Jerome Kassir, who is the Distinguished Professor of Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine. John Walsh, Professor of Public Policy at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Melvin Bernstein, Vice President for Research at the University of Maryland, and also Professor of the Practice in the Department of Material Sciences and Engineering there. Rochelle Dreyfus, who is the Pauline Newman Professor of Law at New York University School of Law. And Sheldon Krimsky, Professor of Urban and Environmental Policy and Planning in the School of Arts and Sciences at Tufts University. So I'd like to start with Jerry Kassir, if you've got introductory comments.
Thank you for the invitation to participate in this discussion of intellectual property. I missed the conference call, so I decided to write a few things down. And I'd like to make one major point in this introduction, and that is that excessive involvement of medicine in commerce has, I think, warped the social fabric of the medical profession. One putative influence on the profession is the Bayh-Dole Act. And if I were the editor of a prominent journal, as I have been in the past, and if I received a paper giving this legislation credit for either success in patenting discoveries or for increasing the interest and profits in our universities, I would reject that paper in a heartbeat. Simply put, we have no controls, so we have no idea what would have happened without the Bayh-Dole Act. So all we can do is make observations and speculate how they came about. But I've had the good fortune to be in medicine for about 50 years, and during that time, my patients and I personally have benefited enormously from the discovery and innovation in the universities and in the pharmaceutical industry and in the device industry. I have one of those arthritis in my knee, actually. And in the past 2 decades, however, I have become increasingly concerned, as many people have, with the personality, the character, and the social fabric of the medical profession. And as an editor during the decade of the 90s, I commented frequently on an erosion of professionalism, a mentality of physicians unduly focused on money, and the consequent financial conflicts of interest. Much of the concern that physicians are putting their own interests above that of their patients is based on anecdotes, but the number and the variety of anecdotes is pretty overwhelming. There's a perception that it's a profession in which researchers formerly savored ideas, chased hypotheses to their lair, immediately shared their results with their peers, and had little interest in equity or royalties. And that profession has now evolved into one in which the time, energy, and resources, not only of researchers, but also of institutional leaders, are supporting a coterie of IP staffers and lawyers chasing an impossible dream of winning the lottery. In fact, hitting the jackpot is a dream realized by perhaps a dozen universities, and many others retain IT offices despite ongoing losses. Another perception is that secrecy has trumped openness, that publications have been delayed, and scientists have not been able to get materials salient to their work. Some scientists admit that they modified their results to suit the requests of study sponsors. Given this quest in medicine for wealth, perhaps consequent on Bayh-Dole, but also easily attributed to the folly of the pharmaceutical industry in seducing doctors to promote their products, it often seems as if the entire profession is chasing free stuff. And at the same time, seemingly upright doctors have tried, often unsuccessfully, to hide these forbidden fruits from the public, a recondite approach that has stimulated a gotcha subculture in which one physician outs another's to undeclared conflicts. In turn, the profession has responded by creating systems to, quote, manage financial conflicts, namely by disclosing them, which in my opinion is a non-solution. Disclosure may be a necessary response, but certainly not a sufficient one. All of this breeds distrust. Distrust is the last attribute that any profession, or for that matter, any business needs. The entire world operates on trust. Universities and medical centers are a public trust as they try to optimize their licensing operations and revenue from equities. They must not forget that their real mission is to maximize their contributions to science, education, and clinical care. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you all for coming here. This is the morning discussion was very lively. I expect it'll continue. I want to talk very briefly about sort of the norms of science and then some, if you will, a kind of very high-level summary of sort of the literature on, you know, examining some of these questions. And, you know, there's sort of well-documented evidence that there's a lot more sort of commercial-oriented activity in universities over the last couple decades. I won't get into whether Bayh-Dole was the cause of that or not. Other people here have looked at that closely. And the question is this eroding the norms of science? And I'll throw out a few sort of norms as they're understood and what we know about them. One is the norm of disinterestedness, that we're not supposed to be driving our science on the basis of our sort of personal interests. And this, you know, the conflict of interest debates are one of these. And there's a lot of research that shows that, you know, particularly in biomed, but not only in biomed, that faculty often get industry funding. There's at least one nice study that shows that there's some evidence that, you know, if you get industry funding, you're more likely to find pro-industry results in your research, and this is cause for concern. There's another norm of autonomy that's related, which is that the faculty should be driven by their sort of scientific inquiry. They shouldn't be sort of driven by either, you know, sort of commands from the state or you know, direction from industry sponsors. And so one of the questions is there a kind of redirection of the research effort as a result of this sort of increasing opportunities to commercialize the research? And there's mixed evidence on this. Some people say, yes, this seems to be happening. Other people say, no, there's not much evidence for this one. The area that I've done more work in, and Wes Cohen and I have done a lot together on this, has to do with the norm of communism, which is that scientific results should be available to everybody. And I'm using Merton's sort of typology here. And so the question is there increased secrecy, increased sort of withholding from the commons, common pool of knowledge of scientific discoveries? And there are several sort of variations that can take. One is, are you willing to talk about your ongoing research? And, you know, before you've sort of established your priority to it. And there's some evidence that people are becoming less willing to talk about their ongoing research, and you can think of sort of the adverse effects that might have. But that the evidence suggests that that's at least as much associated with concerns about scientific competition and priority as it is with patenting specifically or commercial activity more generally. The next kind of secrecy then is you have a result, are you delaying the publication of that result, or are you editing the content? As somebody said, do you leave the secret sauce out of the publication? It's hard to tell whether that's gotten more common or not because of the way things have been measured in several studies. But there's some evidence that this happens. It's not that rare, and that it seems to be associated with industry funding, and this has been sort of shown over and over again. Then the question is, once the thing is published, are you willing to share the materials and the data that come out of the publication as is expected by funders, by journals, and by the norms of the discipline? There's some evidence, again, that this is becoming, that scientists are less willing to share their materials or share their data than they were in the past. Although, in the study that we did looking at genomics and proteomics that was funded by the national academies, but blame them for this result, is that it was still the case that 80% of requests for materials were fulfilled, and without a lot of evidence that there's sort of, you know, strong sanctions for not fulfilling, you know, that the journals or NIH come after you, but that it suggests that the norm is still very fairly strong, but that, you know, perhaps weakening. Again, scientific competition is a major driver of this being unwilling to share, as well as commercial activity. Again, patenting per se doesn't seem to be the main driver, but more general interest in commercialization. One of the things that's interesting, the National Academies looked at this, and they basically made a recommendation that, you know, published results should be available to anybody for any reason. It doesn't matter if they're in industry or in universities, whether this is for commercial or non-commercial, whether they're competitors or not. What was interesting about that is that report actually included a minority opinion, which is not, as I understand, very common with the National Academies reports, that basically said, look, because I've put effort in this, because my reputation depends on this, because it's important for me to sort of fully exploit my own discovery, it's not unreasonable to withhold some of my materials for a period of time. Okay, so even in that case, there's some dissent about what the norm ought to be, but there is evidence that there's some increased withholding of those materials. Then the question is, what's the impact of this? And the main question is does this withholding of, you know, the secrecy, the publication delay, the unwillingness to share, the existence of patents, delay or prevent certain lines of research? There's very little evidence that patents block access, that patents per se block access by academics to research areas. Now, there is some evidence, Bob and Sampat, I think, is here, Fiona Murray and some of her colleagues have done work in this area. What they sometimes find, depending on what you look at, is that you can sort of tease out a small decrease in statistically significant, but on the order of 10 or 20% of decrease in the number of citations that happen to a particular line of research when the thing goes on patent. We can talk about the details of that. Or the reverse, there's a recent paper that showed in the case of the oncomycin and Creelox, and I think we have some people here who were involved in that story, that once that memorandum of understanding was sort of settled, then the citations went up a bit, right? So there's some evidence there that the existence of patenting, or in this case licensing terms, may be related to access, but other work that we've done, again, working with the national academies that they help fund this, was that that this didn't prevent people from doing research in particular areas, and it was unlikely even to delay the research, the patent per se. Now, getting access to the materials, because the material itself is often critical for moving the science forward, can have effects on delay, and we say it's becoming less common there's an increase in withholding there. And so we do need to think about that. But again, it's not clear that the patent is the cause of that, or that changing the patent rules would improve that situation. So we can talk about that. And then finally, we had in the conference call a discussion that I want to raise here, and it's related to the prior panel, which is, if we think about addressing some of these issues, one of the things we want to think about is the extent to which we want to address things at the sort of activities of the scientists and the sort of norms of the scientists and the changing norms and perceptions and attitudes of the scientists and the norms and attitudes and strategies of the universities and their tech transfer offices, their provost, their administration, right? So some of these things, we talked about is there's a conflict perhaps between what the scientist wants to do and what the university wants to do, and we can sort of explore that when we talk about possible remedies. And finally, when we talk about remedies, we should be clear that make sure the solutions then are tied to the problems. There's lots of potential solutions thrown out there, but we want to focus on where the problems are and see if the solutions match up. And also that, most of this discussion has to do with, are there non-zero costs? And what I just summarized is we can find non-zero costs in the current system. But we haven't actually talked about potential benefits of this, and we should sort of balance these potential costs or observed costs against observed benefits, which we perhaps need more research on. Thank you.
Is this going to go on? Yeah. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about sort of some of the other activities in universities, focusing on the physical sciences and engineering than some of the others. And like most of us, we've had varying backgrounds. I started my career at Carnegie Mellon, where as a faculty member, everybody was entrepreneurial, or at least everybody convinced themselves they were entrepreneurial. And I can assure you, to some of the remarks from the previous panel, your ability to be able to either do patents or start companies or be part of that culture was looked upon very favorably. I mean, it was sort of a cultural issue within that university. And then years later, I found myself and noticed that there were three of us from Tufts University here, so you're going to hear from sort of the view from the university that looks down on Harvard, I think is the usual line, right? And my role there was, I was responsible for most of the university except for the medical school. So that part, and I'm trying to remember, and I'm pretty sure we had a technology transfer office, but if we did, it was very small, not very driven, not very involved in the activities. So it was really not central to the mission of the arts and sciences and engineering. And then I find myself at the University of Maryland, sort of my first public university, and some very interesting lessons I'm learning and which have some impact on some of our discussion. You may have heard that state budgets are under enormous stress. The legislatures now are talking about cuts. I mean, you hear cuts now in some of the systems across the country of an excess of 20% of the state part of the funding, which is an incredibly difficult thing to respond to. So one of the things that we do, going back to our legislature and our governor, is to say you can't do that because we're the economic engine for the state. We generate technology. We transfer technology. We create jobs. We we help companies become established. And having said that, then the real issue is who does that, and it's usually the faculty. So we have this sort of environmental stress or shift that now is in, at least implicitly encouraging faculty to think about the kind of research that they would undertake that does readily transfer out into the marketplace. And of course, we're not talking about all the faculty. Maryland has somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 faculty and faculty researchers. We're probably looking at 10% of that group. And many of them are serial entrepreneurs who have company after company who has, and you know, the line is you really never succeed unless you fail three or four times. And there are some of them who are working hard at least at the former part of that. But there are others who have been successful, and they are, and we have operations that we can talk about that help to support them. But it was pointed out, and this is another issue that I hope we can discuss, it's become, again, quite important in the physical sciences and engineering, that most of our involvement with the outside world is not with spin-off companies or small companies, it's with large companies. And most of these now are relationships that you build, individual faculty member or groups of faculty. And here we're finding a different kind of tension that are causing faculty to have to make choices about the kind of research that they're going to work on. And they're usually roughly in three different areas. One is the IP issue, who controls the IP and the nature of that control, publications, and in many of the things that we're working on, issues related to export control. Is this work now sensitive in terms of its competitiveness in this country? And I'm not talking about classified research. I'm talking about that whole range of activities that make the United States competitive in a global world. These are causing significant challenges to faculty who often think about the kind of choices that they make. And sometimes, frankly, they don't think the problem all the way through, is they'll say, well, I really need the support of this research to be able to support my graduate student. And then you point out, but the company wants publication restrictions on this work. Well, then that's a problem. Or I really need to, I have some wonderful students, you say, but some of them are foreign born. That's a problem. And so you're now finding faculty really caught in this dilemma of asking whether it's important enough to fund the research. It's probably less of an issue about whether it's applied or basic. I think we could have an interesting discussion if anybody nowadays in this world can really discriminate between just knowledge discovery. She came off a plane from Tokyo. I came off a plane from Paris last night. So we'll see who dozes off first. But these are issues that are becoming increasingly a challenge, and particularly as the funding patterns in large research universities change, where we increasingly look to corporations for support, we're now going to have to evaluate that in terms of the fundamental mission of the university.
Rochelle.
Thank you for inviting me.
I know, I'm so sorry.
Everybody's sort of starting with a biography. Very early in my career teaching, I was put on the university committee on IP ownership. And so I've been dealing with these issues for 25 years now and written about them as well. And as a result of having written about them very early on, soon after the Bayh-Dole Act was passed, soon after universities started changing their IP policies, I had some of the only articles out there at the time, and so people from lots of universities have called me when they've had problems, both research. I think there are still areas where you do see differences between them, where the big leaps are the fundamental research, and then the applied research is much more focused. The Bayh-Dole Act was intended to let universities do what they were doing and simply transfer technology. But I think there is some degree to which it's also changing the work that universities do and therefore output. The Thursbys have probably done the most work on that. They find fairly small changes in the output of universities. But I think it's important to realize that patenting is somewhat viral in the sense that people find that the best predictor of whether an academic will patent is whether he's worked with other people who have patented. And that means that we might be 10% now, but there's kind of an exponential growth factor in this, and we might be seeing a lot more of it. And so that might lead to some changes in the future. We talked on the last panel about tenure committees and whether they look at patents. At one time, they were disqualifying, and as we heard, now they're either tolerated or valued, and that's also going to change the direction that faculty research takes. So that's agenda setting. The second, and the one that I've worried about the most, is pedagogy. So the university's main goal I would have taken to be the creation of human capital, to nurturing careers. Students, PhD students, undergraduate students, postdocs, they're the cheap labor of the academic enterprise, but there's a trade-off there. Slavery in exchange for portable reputational gains, credit, reputation, that helps them to enter the job market. And I think we are starting to see some changes there. You see it in the case law, you see it in the kind of inquiries that I've gotten. Credit is much more hotly contested now. Some of that has to do with the way that patent law deals with questions of inventorship and ownership. And I'd like to get back to that in a minute. Some of it has to do with something the last panel was talking about, faculty or some people at the university sort of taking the work and leaving some people out in the cold. So they contributed to the work, but they're somehow not contributing to the patents or not named on the patents and not part of the spin-offs and the licensing and all that comes with that. There are also some questions of projects that are being assigned to students based not so much on their instructiveness as much as on the commercial interest of the professor. And I think you actually pointed to that in what you just said. Mobility is becoming a particular problem. You think about knowledge embedded in what people actually know. You see some universities claiming that knowledge. So one case about a couple of faculty members who left a U.S. university to go to a Japanese university were charged with economic espionage, which is in fact a felony. I had a TTO calling me to ask whether or not a student's training could be conceptualized as the university's trade secret. Well, you know, if human capital can't move to its highest and best use, then we have a real problem. The third one is mentoring. So the notion of, you know, how it is that the older faculty kind of bring up the young faculty that are in their universities. The tenure question, I think, is an especially interesting one. You saw here discussion where people didn't know what the tenure rules were of their own universities. For young faculty, that's a problem, too, where they actually don't even know whether or not they should be looking for patents, avoiding patents. That's a really difficult problem for somebody trying to get tenure. Viral patenting also suggests that there is, not to mix metaphors, an old boy network. And I do mean an old boy network. So there is some research showing that the impact of this new commercialization, in which people get hired as consultants, get included in spin-offs, are part of the licensing deal, is something that is accruing to white men more than it is to anybody else in the universities. So we have this phenomenon that's happening, which is just as the glass ceiling is breaking, a new glass ceiling is getting created, so that some of the people being hired by the university for the first time are now finding themselves in a particularly bad situation. And then, of course, there's the public interest, and that was talked about at the last panel, the notion that fundamental research now goes to who can afford to pay for it. So a real change from kind of the ag school model of state universities, where the research was there to benefit the local farmers, universities, NYU's motto is a private university in the public interest, but I think we are starting to see that local communities are having a harder time getting a hold of some information. Developing countries, which used to be the consumers of faculty research, having a harder time. Orphan problems, neglected diseases, for example, and of course, nonprofits' ability to do research is being hampered by the existence of patents, as John talked about before. Now, before I give up the floor, I'd like to spend at least a minute on questions of how you would actually try to ameliorate the downsides of the Bayh-Dole Act. There's lots of work being done by industrial organization types, and Siobhan Omahoney's name comes to mind, on how you deal with the problem of norms colliding. On the one hand, you have industrial norms, on the other hand, you have academic norms, and how do you keep them, separate and not kind of running into each other? And one possibility is boundary organizations. So an organization that stands between the two and that kind of helps mediate the conflicts. The TTOs, of course, are one, the technology transfer officers are one possible boundary organization. We talked about them before. But government funding organizations are, of course, another one. Currently, the Bayh-Dole Act is interpreted to give the government agencies very little authority to do anything but help promote technology transfer. But the Bayh-Dole Act is actually quite capaciously written. There's a lot of public regarding knowledge in it. So although nobody wants to reopen the Bayh-Dole Act to change the legislation, there's actually quite a lot of room to reinterpret what the Bayh-Dole Act says. And for example, it could be done by executive order. So we have a new administration utilizing the kind of public regarding language in the Bayh-Dole Act to reinterpret the power of the NIH, for example, to actually enforce its guidelines on licensing rather than simply suggesting them. I think would be one way to go. I also agree that patent reform is not likely to happen, but I do think there are some roles for courts in the way the patent law is interpreted. So there have been several post-Bayh-Dole cases from the Federal Circuit, the court that deals with patent law, Mady against Duke, against Cannavaro, and Ray Kloffenstein's, and they take kind of a bipolar view of the academy. The academy is either public regarding or it's commercial. And mostly they take the view that the university is a patent holder who's behaving badly. And I think that could change. There could be ways of looking at the university as, you know, a somewhat different kind of holder and transfer of intellectual property. And it would be good if somebody could sort of bring that out and make courts more attentive to the problems that universities have and the differences between universities and true commercial actors. There's also that question of patent inventorship and patent ownership. Currently, the rules are that if you are an inventor on any one claim in a patent, then you are a patentee for the entire patent, and you own the entire patent, and you have an absolute right to license it on your own. And that means to license it competitively with the other licensees. And that creates huge incentives to push people off these patents, huge incentives to deny credit to postdoc students and various of the less powerful people at the university. And that's something that I think could also change my common law rule. I'm the Judge Newman Professor of Law, so Judge Newman has written many dissents on this question of how you would interpret patent ownership. So again, a report that points out that this is a problem would, I think, be a very good result. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to start with thinking about the metaphor of blurring sector boundaries. Just think about the way that sector boundaries have been blurred with respect to entertainment and serious news between banks and financial houses, between regulators and manufacturers. And in some sense, I think one of the tragedies of the current financial crisis has been in part the result of the idea of blurring the boundaries between sectors. And this is, in fact, has been one of the issues with Bayh-Dole and with other efforts to try to create stronger ties between industry and between universities. The superposition of academic and industrial values, each coherent in their own right, are frequently in opposition. I mean, that's one of the problems. And superposition or blending usually means that academic values are compromised. And that's been the movement. Institutional norms are redefined. And it's easy to measure financial gains or losses of universities when they engage in business ventures. Much more difficult to calibrate or measure the losses in traditional academic values, rise in ghostwriting or conflicts of interest or secrecy, much more difficult to evaluate those. So I wanted to say a few words about the liabilities. The Bayh-Dole Act created not the only thing, for sure, because there were many other executive decisions, decisions made about the tax law. The group of these created a new set of structural relations for university-industry partnerships. First time I talked about this publicly was in 1980, when Nature magazine spent 6 hours with me in a room with David Baltimore and said, what's going to happen with all the development of commercial activities in universities? It's public now. I mean, it was published in 1980 in Nature, and we both have our predictions. The new structural relations of university-industry partnerships are a well-accepted outcome. There's not much controversy that these structural relationships have taken place. And I want to say a word about some of the liabilities and the empirical evidence for it, whether it's strong or weak or whatever. First of all, conflicts of interest among faculty in the biomedical sciences, especially egregious in biomedical sciences, is fairly well documented. The fact that these conflicts of interest, however you define them, they're defined in several ways, but that they have increased is fairly well documented. Secrecy and changing norms and sharing knowledge and cell lines among academic scientists, also heightened in the biomedical sciences, also fairly well documented. There's more trade secrets reported among faculty with industrial research, etc. A lot of work was done by David Blumenthal, a lot of survey work. I don't know if it's kept up to date, but there's a lot of good evidence there. Institutional equity in faculty-initiated companies has increased. More universities want a piece of the equity pie. In a few cases, it has resulted in large paybacks to the university. In at least one case that I know, it has resulted in enormous loss from a litigation. Many of you may know that the Jesse Gelsinger case, the University of Pennsylvania, was the first major piece of litigation directed at a university in which the core part of the complaint was conflict of interest. It was negotiated out of court. Exclusive licensing of intellectual property has increased at universities, not always in the public interest or in the interest of university researchers. That's also documented. There's pressure on university administrators, IP agents of the university, to accept secrecy in research and contract agreements that give the private sponsor rights over publication and patents. If you talk to people who work in the IP sections of universities, they will tell you about the stress they have to face in trying to get the agreement, get the contract, get the funding, and at the same time hold the line on some of the university values. It's not always easy, and the pressure comes from all directions, including the investigator. Standards of managing, including preventing conflicts of interest, vary significantly across research universities and medical schools. Government obviously was quite concerned about conflicts of interest and set down some requirements that the universities have to manage their conflicts of interest. But the management varies so widely, there's hardly any standard norms. U.S. medical schools found, a survey of U.S. medical schools found that only 21 of 150 schools surveyed have strong policies on conflict of interest with respect to pharmaceutical companies. The industry sponsors of research in drugs have availed themselves of the permissive atmosphere of academic free market norms in becoming more aggressive in recruiting ghostwriters, so that we're beginning to see secrecy, sequestered research, and private dissertation defenses as something that universities are willing to trade off for the funded research. And of course, this was mentioned, but industry-funded studies have been linked to outcomes that are more likely than not to support the financial interests of the private sponsor as compared to similar studies of government and nonprofit sponsors. I've called this the funding effect. It's a pretty serious effect, and there's a lot of research that demonstrates it. The Beckelman study in JAMA, strong and consistent evidence, shows that industry-sponsored research tends to draw pro-industry conclusions. This goes right to the heart of what the university is supposed to be about, namely producing knowledge that's credible and that's not biased in the direction of a particular sponsor. When asked whether they ever change the design methodology or results of a study in response to pressure from a funding source, 20.5% of mid-career scientists and 9.5% of early career scientists answered yes. This was a Nature survey. 20% said that they changed the design methodology or results of a study in response to pressure from a funding source. So these are the issues that we face if we want to imagine that the university is going to be colonized, which it could very well be and is being in some cases, by other sectors and turns itself into something quite different. That's a possibility. When entire departments at major public universities like Berkeley will actually sell departments to a company so that 30 out of 32 members of the department are on contract and are limited from their interactions with other companies and what they can disclose about their research, this is a serious issue. There is insufficient data and studies on the impact of university industry collaborations on the quality of university research. But there is some survey data that shows that faculty with industrial funding are more likely than those without such funding to choose their research topic based upon the commercial considerations. But we don't have a lot of research in that area. So I think these are some of the liabilities that we're facing, and they're pretty serious. So I think we have to take them seriously. Thank you.
So we've heard from the panelists as far, as well as some of the panelists this morning, variety of anecdotal evidence, some empirical evidence that there are changes taking place that or that have taken place in the norms of academics. But moving to the discussion questions and trying to think about particular areas in which we have more than anecdotal evidence that the possibilities of patenting and commercializing research discoveries has really changed particular types of behavior. So John talked a bit about changing behavior regarding the disclosure findings, presentations of papers, informal sharing. What about leading faculty to devote less time to teaching and research, changing the kinds of research projects undertaken? Do we have more than the anecdotal evidence that's been shared about its impacting the criteria for faculty promotion and tenure decisions? And this question is open to any panelist members, but I didn't know, John, if you wanted to say more about that since you've done some empirical.
Oh, sure.
Well, I think that was a point that Rochelle was making as well.
I don't think this is an either or. I think the point is to figure out what distortions is already a loaded word, what changes are happening, whether we like those changes, and if there are some changes that are happening that we don't like, it might be possible to correct that problem without sacrificing the benefits of increasing commercialization.
So.
I think you're right. We've seen examples where government may not like the outcome of research and in a certain segment of the government, and that's also an onerous problem.
I think the point is we really worry about the abuses, and so you know what some people call the slippery slope. I think there are very few universities that will knowingly agree to do classified research on campuses, right? But the question is, as you now move away from that, and I'm thinking now of government-sponsored research, there's a very interesting and potentially dangerous topic called sensitive but unclassified research, which some agencies are now applying. And universities, you know, one of the things that I think is very clear is the university community is not monolithic. I mean, we have universities ranging from a high degree of discomfort of doing anything with industry to those who have worked out very successful, enlightened relationships where the research is published, the students benefit, the faculty grow, and those are things that certainly from my viewpoint should be encouraged. The problem is when there starts to be increasing pressure to sort of deviate from what is our acceptable rules of behavior in terms of whether it's the right to publish or whether it's the kind of controls over the information. Those are the concerns we should be worrying about.
So first, somebody, you raised this point about this, you know, are we holding on to a medieval notion of the purity of science? And, you know, there's work on Galileo, and I got to see the Galileo Museum recently. And, you know, he was sort of... Well, he was famous for, or not famous, but, you know, he engaged in secret publication, right, publishing in riddles and such, and also withholding of research materials, his telescopes, right, in order to generate funding and to, and you know, enhance the reputation of his government sponsor. So, you know, this is a long-standing problem in science. And I think that, I mean, I don't disagree with most of Sheldon's sort of, listing of the kinds of problems we're seeing, and I think it's interesting to think about, okay, well, what are the issues there? And the sort of the core of this is, one question is, do we really want a sort of bright line between the universities and, you know, these sort of secular domains is one issue. And then the other is, even if we do or don't want that, one of the big shifts that we seem to be seeing is this shift towards, if you will, the more entrepreneurial university or academic capitalism. It has different names. But the idea there is that the university scientist is responsible for generating a stream of income both for his own lab and for the maintenance of the university through the indirect cost system. And more universities, as they move into the sort of, you know, research university or nearly research university status, are increasingly pushing in that direction. And I think a lot of the sort of findings that we're talking about here are a result of the desire to sort of operate in that domain, where you need a funding stream, and whether it's I need my next NIH or NSF grant, so I have to get these extra publications and I don't want him to get them, or whether I need, you know, to keep my graduate students fed and I need funding from, you know, the government and from firms and donors and whoever else will give it to me. And the university evaluated me. We talked about evaluation on the basis of patents, but I think we can agree that evaluation on your funding stream, however it comes, is certainly important in the decision. It may not be determinative, but it's definitely in the story. And, you know, universities make some distinction about where the money came from, but, you know, very large funding streams are looked on favorably in many cases. And so we want to kind of think about whether we really want, whether we could even imagine going, you know, to a system where faculty were much less tethered to their sort of project-based funding stream and universities were less tethered to that. And if not, then the question is, what can we do to manage the kinds of conflicts and such that were raised in here?
In NASA, at least, has been an extraordinary evolution in the funding of research in especially in clinical medicine. So as if you look back 10, 15, 20 years, a large fraction of the funding is coming from major source of those new clinical trials is from industry. So what you're seeing now are absolutely enormous clinical trials involving 17,000, the latest Jupiter trial, 17,000 patients, but as many as 40,000 patients. And those trials, numbers are needed, those large numbers are needed to be able to show a very minor difference between the treatment arm and a non-treatment arm. The tendency, of course, is for these investigators to move toward the trials that they can get funding for. And that's obviously problematic. I want to raise one other issue, which it came up just a week or so ago, which was a note from the Internal Revenue Service that sent a 33-page questionnaire to 400 universities asking them questions. Form 14018 inquires how revenues and expenses from business activities are reported, how universities compensate their executives, how they use their endowment, and other financial matters. I don't know if that's new or if that's been done before, but it certainly, is it new?
Yes.
Well, it certainly signals some special interest in the Internal Revenue Service. And you have to imagine, I mean, as universities are doing more and more work with food companies and with pharmaceutical companies and device manufacturers, the question is, how are they going to be perceived by the Internal Revenue Service? How are they going to be perceived not just by the government, but by trial lawyers who no longer are able to sue device manufacturers and may, if the Supreme Court decides it, not be able to sue drug companies anymore because of the FDA proscription? So what are they're going to be out of business unless they can begin to sue universities as businesses. Exactly, that's the point.
I'd like to come back to a couple of points that were made earlier about can we distinguish between changes in norms that are not due to patenting and commercialization concerns, as well as can we distinguish between changes that have been positive? I mean, if all of the norm changes are not negative, what are some of the norm changes that we want to keep, that we want to encourage universities to continue?
Do we have anyone here from NIH, by the way? No? Okay. I'm going to talk for NIH, but hopefully they'll correct me later. As many of you know, NIH had this sort of concern about the, you know, conflicts of interest on the intramural researchers. And what's interesting about that is this sort of very, in a relatively short period of time, going from a policy that we really should encourage this kind of ties between the NIH researchers and industrial researchers to a sort of internal panel that said, okay, we want to kind of manage this, to a policy that basically said, no, you know, we want a bright line, keep these two far apart in sort of the ways that we're suggesting here. And I think that's an interesting case to see that, because it really highlights the tensions here. But I want to read a quote from a scientist who was an NIH scientist. The name is Joseph Mendel. He was quoted in the Scientist magazine during the period of this. And here's what he said: "I'm a nascent tenure track investigator, recently recruited to start an independent basic science lab at NIH." Right. So these are the target, if you will, of some of our discussion. And what he said is, "As such, since I'm junior, no one has yet shown the slightest interest in paying me for my opinions on anything. On the other hand, should a company show an actual interest, I will have an opportunity not only to share my expertise, but also to appreciate a more applied perspective from which my own work can benefit, okay? And, you know, we can, this is perhaps a self-serving claim. He'd like the extra money. But I think it's, you know, we know that there's benefits in both directions, that the sort of co-determination or co-movement of science and technology suggests that there actually are benefits to science from having closer ties with industry, in the sense of getting more interesting problems to work on, getting new insights into scientific problems. There's also benefits in the training, in the sense of it may make it easier to place your students because you have these relations. And of course, this is something the students are very keen on. And also, there's often smart scientists in firms. And, you know, and depending on what, you know, field you're talking about and what period in recent history, you know, there may be more or less of those, but that, you know, to say that the university shouldn't have close access to the scientists in these other domains suggests putting some serious constraints on the university faculty. So I just wanted to bring that up as a reason to sort of allow or perhaps even encourage this kind of thing. I say he might also want that. This is why I was wondering if NIH people were here. Does the consulting ban include unpaid consulting or only paid consulting? Okay.
I think it's more conflict of interest. But, I mean, part of the challenge, and we were talking, you know, some of these things are inevitable if you believe in sort of the way the universities are changing. And Rochelle mentioned that there's sort of a new generation of scientists coming through the academic system. And what do they see? They see NIH saying, we want to support translational research. They see NSF saying that we really want to understand how this research can be applied to solving the nation's problems. They work with faculty who, as part of their portfolio, if they're successful, have lots of consulting both in this country and abroad. So that's sort of the model that you saw. When I was a graduate student, My thesis advisor turned away these agencies. He said, we can't be bothered. He was part of a different generation, of course. So we now have sort of a way of thinking about what the responsibilities of universities are. And if we're going to address the challenging problems, whether it's energy or poverty or global warming, those are going to inevitably bring us into contact with the kind of either industrial government needs that have to be satisfied. And, you know, we can have a useful discussion about whether this changes the university environment. There are some people who say it's actually salutary. It allows you now to take your knowledge, work on discovery, and actually see it for the benefit of mankind. And to the point about money, I mean, the real dilemma is, you know, you ask most faculty, why do they need research dollars? And a very large fraction of them will say, so I can support my students, so I can now provide that environment to allow them, and particularly in the sciences, and life sciences and engineering, which are expensive fields, where do those resources come from? Public universities now receive, on average, about 20% of their funding from the state. We now have created a model which makes us much more entrepreneurial than maybe we even want to be.
it's either or. I think it's a question of identifying what the problems are or what the potential problems are, and then thinking of ways to deal with them. I think, you know, sort of there's another element in it, which is a kind of coordination problem. No one university can easily do this on their own because of the fact that the research will just go to other universities. So the ability of a particular university to set up a policy no-go striking here, some universities can do it. Stanford, I'm sure, has done it. But many universities just can't because the research will just go away. So again, I think there's a role for creating visibility to the problems. And, you know, again, empirical research is wonderful, but I actually think that some of these things are incredibly hard to nail down. And they're hard to nail down because of the fact that this is a change in degree, not a change in kind. But there are some sort of systematic things that clearly could go wrong. Just a little evidence of them indicates that it might be useful to make them visible and also think about ways that either government or a coalition of universities maybe some home for finding the regulations, because to do them one-on-one for many universities would be very difficult.
I'm just going to throw out a couple of... I think we can all understand public health. Somehow, I think... If you feel somehow that the information you're getting in public health is compromised, you're going to be pretty angry. So let me just throw out a couple of things. Lead research at universities, vinyl chloride research, tobacco research, bisphenol A, DBCP, which caused the sterility of workers. These research projects were funded by companies, and there were restrictions on publication. How do you feel about that? They also led to longer periods of time before these areas were regulated. It seems to me that there have to be certain norms that are not compromised. Like when you get a contract in from a company, you have to have total autonomy about how the research is done and whether or not it can be published. We've seen the case in the drug companies where certain research results were constrained from publication. Fortunately, it came out in the public record. But do we want to continue some of the egregious problems of the past where the university is really a kind of contractor of funding sources that serves the interests of the funder? Or whether there are absolutely clear standards of autonomy for researchers and they are protected from the pressures of getting the money if they just accept the compromises that are part of the contract. They may not. And I've spoken to people at Harvard who said, if they don't want us, let them go somewhere else. And that's Harvard, right. But this is why national standards... This is why national standards are important. It seems to me if Bayh-Dole is revised, there's nothing wrong with the government saying whether you take federal funds or private funds, there should be no covenants in the contracts which prevent the investigator from complete autonomy of publication. There shouldn't be any compromises on those points. It may, but it won't have the same value.
Right, so Jerry,
the situation I don't think is quite as bleak as as Jennifer painted it, or in terms of conflict of interest. The AAMC under David Corn had put out two major conflict of interest proposals, and since that time, dozens of universities have picked up and changed strongest rules. I think Brown University had one of the strongest rules just fairly recently. Michigan, too, another that had pretty strong rules. Stanford did pretty well, didn't they? Yeah. I thought, in fact, Stanford's conflict of interest policy, I teach at Stanford a few days a month, so Stanford's policy included CME, continuing medical education, which most other conflict of interest policies don't. And the dean had a lot of trouble with that, getting it through.
Other agencies. It's hard to talk about different agencies because the Department of Defense, of course, is going to have some national security issues. So it's kind of hard to say that there have to be blanket rules for all the agencies. But I think not. You know, I. CDC. I mean, but there might be other agencies that are funding research where this would be perfectly compatible. I'm just not aware of what the situations are there. On the question of what they could do in war, I mean, for one thing, NIH can say, look, here are the guidelines. If you don't obey them, they're not guidelines, right? I guess I wouldn't call them guidelines then. But how you fulfill these guidelines will be taken into account in the next round of research grants that anybody from your university is applying for. They do that with regard to other things. They don't do it with regard to this particular thing, in part because they think they don't have the authority to do it. The NIH conceptualizes what it's doing as promoting technology transfer, i.e. patents, things that the last panel was talking about. But I think they could say that they take that into account, and I think that would help. I think it would give the faculty who don't want to have this all become privatized more of power to say they don't want to do it. And TTOs also is against their administrations and their provosts who want to see more research. They can say, look, you know, we're constrained by these guidelines, or we're going to have a problem down the line. So I think all of that's really possible. In terms of what the Federal Circuit could do, I mean, the current interpretation of the rule on patent ownership is just devastating. Because the current rule, which is a judge-made rule, since the statute is extremely vague on this, says that if you contribute to any one claim, the patent might have 35 claims, you contribute to one of them, you co-own the entire patent. And that means, and then the ownership rule, which is also a common law rule, is wildly different than any other ownership rule we have in the world. You have the right to commercialize it, exploit it, without accounting to anybody else, and without any duty to cooperate with anybody else's attempts to commercialize. You can get rid of both of those rules with a stroke of the pen by simply saying that if you're a co-inventor of one claim, you have rights to that one claim, that the same rule in copyright applies to patents. The rule in copyright is you have a duty to exploit. You have a right to exploit with a duty to account. And that makes all of the difference in terms of exploitation of copyrighted works and patented works. And it's not that they're interpreting a clear statute. They've made these rules up.
For the accounting statute, statute. The ownership statute does actually say that you don't have to account. So that would require,
okay,
but,
so
but it's the inventorship one that the Federal Circuit has kind of created this interpretation.
There's an activity, perhaps an attempt to start to do some of this. I think you're aware in the Academy, the Government University Industrial Roundtable has been discussing, it seems almost forever, but let's say 3 to 5 years, driven largely by industry arguing that they can't work with universities because universities are so difficult in terms of protecting their own rights, which, of course, if you're in a university, you have a slightly different opinion on the subject. But one of the results of this has been an attempt to develop sort of rules of behavior. It's a device that they're calling the Turbo Negotiator, which really lays out the kind of challenges and conflicts at universities and industry, and really talking about sort of the two extremes, pharma on one side and IT on the other side, who have very different time frames and needs, and to try and develop an activity and a document that both sides can live with. But I do want to go back to something. So much of what I've heard, and I'm not a life scientist, so much of what I've heard here, the kind of abuses and problems, frankly, don't exist in the physical sciences and engineering, certainly not to the degree that you're describing them here. And I'm sort of wondering if the problem then is a little narrowly focused in that area, because there's an awful lot of other research that goes on at universities.
That's a helpful question to ask. What's the gold standard, as well as something that was asked before in terms of what norms really cannot be compromised at a minimum that we need to ensure?
Yeah. I'm not going to answer this in the broadest sense, but I want to answer in a more narrow sense, because one of the things is that the discussion is, I think, bleeding heavily over into what the next session is going to be about, which is the industry funding discussion. And I want to sort of shift towards the sort of universities patenting and licensing practices, and which is not completely divorced from the funding sources, but in this case, focus on the issues around sharing of data and materials, and you know, which is something that we could also talk about. And I think here the gold standard, as I said, you know, that the National Academy sort of said, okay, what should this be? And, it, you know, we were just having a sidebar here about, you know, what is it in other fields? And, you know, if I publish a research result, there's this expectation that to promote the progress of science and to sort of contribute to the scientific community and to be able to check each other's work, I should, you know, I'm obligated that anyone who asks send me, you know, I send them my data, I send them my materials, you know, cell lines, whatever the relevant stuff is. And, you know, we can see that as a gold standard. Now, two issues there, and I said that even in that National Academies report, there was an understanding that, well, wait a minute, in a competitive scientific field, there may be reasons why I might want to, not never, but for a little while, you know, maintain some exclusivity over the research results that I've created. I mean, it's actually sort of interesting. You know, all of us who've, you know, sort of been involved in this, you know, you can think about all the times you've asked and all the times you've been asked, and did you, you know, uniformly send or receive every single time? And, you know, I've been on both ends of this, and, you know, the answer is not every time on either end. But then the question is why, right? And so I would like to sort of broaden this out then. It's like, why is it then that we don't always respond to these? We don't always share when we're asked. And is it in fact, if you will, functional for the working of science and what we would like to have happen to allow, you know, me to get my next publication, to allow my student to finish his dissertation before I give it to a well-funded and very fast rival who might, you know, scoop my own student, who might scoop myself on my own publication? These things all happen. And, you know, what our research shows is that mostly people comply with these requests. They don't always. One reason they don't is concern about scientific competition, and Campbell's research shows the same thing. Commercial concerns also are relevant, and that the inability to get this stuff can have adverse effects. It can slow your research down. Even, you know, we asked, you know, does it slow it more than a month? But in many fields, more than a month is a significant slowdown.
So I'll answer the question, the norms for medicine. The norms that seem to me would be the integrity of the information, the integrity of recommendations that people make, and the last is the best interest of patient care.
About the physical sciences.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think we've all been on both sides of this issue. And most of us, I think, in sort of the physical sphere, will accept as part of an agreement with industry a delay in publication to allow them to review, not to decide whether it should be published or not, but that it gives them sort of the first look at the work that they've sponsored. And I think that tends to be general across the But the world that I, you know, you were asking about material science, we're anxious to publish. Okay? You know, it's sort of our gold standard. It allows us then to be competitive in a world where your funding is made available to you by the quality and the impact of what your research is. So while there are clearly going to be examples of maybe a little bit of foot dragging, I'm not convinced that is sort of normal.
Sharing of the materials after publication is the next question.
Well, certainly in my field we do that. You know, part of it is this, it's the issue that always comes up. If you give somebody sort of can they reproduce what you've done? You know, it's an issue I spent a little bit of time in the government, and the concern there was, well, if we publish sort of the genetic makeup of penicillin, it's going to be all over something worse than that. As long as you have a multi-billion-dollar lab and 50 scientists working 5 years. I mean, so it's a matter of relevance and degree, and I think the general feeling is openness of scientific exchange should always trump any concerns about the conflicts.
Yeah.
think one of the tech transfer officers could probably answer this or make this comment better, but I know Stanford often does this, California often does this, that it's sort of autumn best practice now is to make that kind of a clause very standard in a licensing agreement. I don't know, I haven't seen data on just how common it is. No, well, what it says is, some version of it is that basically we and all of our friends get to continue practicing it. Basically, it's this university and any other, you know, university or nonprofit organizations that yeah, and so that's, you know, and does anyone know, does Autumn have any data on like what percentage of licensing contracts now have this term?
It's interesting you say that because the previous panel discussed, among other things, the possibility of each inventor keeping his IP, and I think that actually is one of the difficulties with that is that you could have assignment policies. Now, you know, but even assignments can be tricky for students, for example. So the notion of, you know, having a student sign up and you know, when you sign up at a university, you assign all your patent rights to the university, is, you know, it's a difference. I mean, maybe you're right, that's the way to do it, but students don't expect, as they're shelling out money, to also have to shell out rights to all future patents while they're at the university. If you read on in that paper, he talks about how some of the California universities reserve the right only for other California universities. Yeah. Or variations. Beatty case, which is the one that seems to have taken away the research exemption, there's a footnote on how much money Duke has made off of patent licensing. And so it's what I'm saying about the sort of this bipolar notion that if you're going to make money, then you are not a nonprofit researcher. And that's part of what needs to change.
In the public, the Q&A part of the session now, if nobody else has questions, I did want to go back to the idea that John had mentioned in the beginning about the different point of view that you take if you're talking about researchers, if you're talking about university administrators and tech transfer folks, if you're talking about students in terms of changing norms. Can you say some more?
Yeah, I'm now in the world of anecdote. So that in this issue of sort of control over the property rights related to scientific results, particularly related to the sharing of materials, so we have these things that, you know, the faculty hold back, you know, because they want to make money off of it, because they want to get more publications off of it, because it's a lot of trouble to make copies of certain things, or they might have only limited amounts. But they might also hold back because their university tells them they must. And there's at least anecdotes of this where the professor was freely sharing his mice or, you know, other materials, and gets sort of notice from his tech transfer office that said, excuse me, this isn't yours, and you can't be giving it away. So I don't know, actually, but that sort of sets up this point about the professor has a certain set of interests, the researcher, and the university has a certain set of interests, and sometimes they align and sometimes they don't. And in this point about, you know, yes, from my point of view of sort of advancing science, and that's sort of what I was trying to say, is that, you know, in order for us to all be able to replicate each other, we have to share these things. But at the same time, the university may be saying, well, in order for me to secure my, funds from this thing, I need to limit access, and I may have already agreed to give somebody exclusive access, or I may be trying to do that, right? And so, you know, here's just a purely anecdote. But the question is more generally the extent to which the goals of the university to try and generate a revenue stream and the goals of the professors to try to generate his own reputation, his own revenue stream, and to sort of participate in the, you know, community of science are in conflict. Elaborate on that example, please. No, but I mean, tell me what happened. Thank you.
So is there a way to, or what would be the best approach, I guess, to standardize some of these norms that we think are critically important? We've already said that universities doing it individually is not likely to be successful. I mean, should it happen through funding agencies? Do we actually need something broader than that in terms of amendments to Bayh-Dole? Can we, through executive orders, accomplish what needs to happen in terms of making sure that minimum norms that are valued are maintained in universities?
Sometimes, and that's journals. So my understanding is that some of the journals have policies about sharing also. So if you publish there, you have to make lines available. And you know, mice have been a big problem. You have to make them available in 2 years or something so that you can get your own research out of it first. So there's, you know, there are other actors in the system.
Is it the case that these repositories will take all comers? I mean, or do they screen? Because you can think of all the things that were published, right? And so, you know, and the journals require that you share, right? And, you know, the normal, I mean, a common way that happens is you get a, you know, a request saying, you know, could I have, you know, it's a direct request. And you might say it's in a repository and you can go get it there. But is it the case that, you know, your solution of why isn't this, you know, can I just, everything we publish, we just send to the repository? Is that the case? Or, I mean, I think with the sequences that what, you know, the, with the GenBank and the Protein Data Bank, that is the case, but there's sort of the costs are different. But for cell lines or, you know, mice, things like that, or, you know, new materials in material science, you know, is it possible to do that? Now, I mean, without changing anything, is it possible to do that? Or do these people screen what you see? My understanding is they screen, but I could be wrong.
Well, the Carolina
maybe we could start. I was looking at what the title of this session was. I went, you know, on the norms of the university. I mean, and for those of us who have spent a lot of time in universities, I think, you know, we certainly recognize the stresses that exist. A lot of it is driven by funding, by the need to sort of the model that we've established to support particularly graduate research. And we can all point anecdotally to faculty who have gone off the reservation, who have sort of behavior, norms of behavior which are really not central to the institution. We can also point to universities that have a much more flexible view about what some of the things they will accept and not. But, you know, somebody had asked whether there were, you know, devices in place to ensure that faculty act accordingly and students. And certainly from my experience, the answer to that is yes. That there are clearly examples where we had to deal with faculty, or, and particularly more faculty than students, I think, and more actually tenured faculty than research faculty who were sort of driven by different needs. But the university community tends to sort of self-police itself in a lot of different ways. And there may be a time lag, and I know that Shelley has lots of examples of times when we really sort of tilted too far on the other side, but the values are there. And, you know, and hopefully these kinds of self-examinations will help us.
So, but is there a sense that policing is successful, or is the time lag too far that?
Well, again, I mean, I come from, you know, I'm fascinated by the world of the medical world and all these stresses and incredible temptations. At least, you know, in the science, in the physical sciences and engineering, you might count on the fingers of one hand the number of patents that have given universities large amounts of money. I mean, this is not what's, you know, most of this are somebody develops embedded software. I mean, they're not going to build an airplane and put it on there. I mean, so that the drivers are very different. I mean, the fundamental drivers to be able to get support to continue your research. research. If you can make a little bit of additional money through consulting and other activities, all to the good. But the value system doesn't seem to have been potentially distorted the way it sounds like it could be in the public health arena.
Over the past 50 years, the government has actually had a lot of regulations with respect to universities. I mean, you think of IRBs, that whole system, which came about in the 70s and requires the university to meet certain standards in human experiments. Or you think of OSHA and standards for the use of chemicals and biologicals. You think of radiation standards at universities. They have to meet federal standards in the use of certain materials. And, you know, most recently, the government has basically said you've got to have conflict of interest management procedures. But they, you know, nobody in the federal government has indicated what should go into those management procedures. You know, maybe there could be some fill-in to what minimum standards are for universities in terms of managing conflicts of interest, just as the government has standards for its own conflicts of interest, although it doesn't always follow them. It always occurred to me that there were two rules for conflicts of interest on federal advisory committees. Rule one, number one, was anybody with a substantial conflict of interest could not serve on a federal advisory committee. And rule number two is that rule number one can be waived. And hopefully, maybe that standard of waiver will be readjusted. But it does seem to me that the standards across universities vary so significantly in terms of the norms of what is permitted, that some very basic ones ought to be uniform, and I don't know that they can be achieved by the professional societies. There needs to be some, I hate to use this word, but maybe higher authority in terms of securing that the trust in the knowledge that comes out of American institutions.
Thank you.
actually, this brings up an interesting point, and I haven't seen research on this, and I'd be thrilled if someone could point me towards it. There's a lot of research on sort of conflicts of interest and potential adverse effects of that. But this my question is there research on the extent to which these, for example, getting funding from industry affects the credibility of the spokesman, the scientist, right? So in a simple example, if people gave testimony at the national academies or at a congressional hearing and said, I got funding from, you know, a pharmaceutical firm, right, and I think that we should do X, right, or you mentioned tobacco and other ones, right, and, you know, tobacco may be the canonical case where as soon as you say that, they just shut off your microphone and nobody's listening. On the other hand, you know, in material science, if somebody says, I got funding from, you know, this firm, and I think that, you know, superconductivity could be really critical for reducing energy use, right? Does that person's microphone immediately get cut? Do people stop listening to that person because he had funding from industry? So one question is the extent to which there is a policing mechanism and how is it operating in that people consume the scientific, you know, these ghost-written papers, I don't know, how credible are they? But more generally across fields, is there variation in whether we believe people if they have these kind of ties or not? Right, but I'm saying even in the evidence of disclosure, right, does that affect how we believe them or not?
Well, there is ample data from guideline development, clinical practice guideline development, from a variety of medical professional organizations in which the information on conflict of interest was disclosed, and the guideline, it turned out, turned out to be biased in favor of a company based on conflicts of interest within the guideline development group. And there are perhaps a half dozen or a dozen such examples. One example in particular was the Endocrine Society put out guidelines on the use of testosterone in old guys like me. And a large number of the panelists were conflicted. That is, they had deals with either testing organizations or companies that made the drug. And a separate panel that had no conflicts of interest at the NIH came up with a completely different conclusion. And the Endocrine Society was embarrassed by the fact that they had these panelists who that came to a different conclusion and were all, not all, but many of them had substantial financial conflicts of interest. There are a bunch of other examples, and I'll give you my book to explain them.
Last comment in the back.
Oh, you're absolutely right. These cases are decade at the New England Journal of Medicine, when we had papers from companies, we scrutinized them a lot more closely than we did than papers that came from the NIH. Whether that's correct or not is a serious question. I mean, there could be bias in all kinds of studies.
Well, we're doing a study right now to see what kinds of journals will give that information to peer reviewers. Only a small proportion of the journals actually disclose the conflict of interest information to the peer reviewers so that, you know, they can't ratchet up their skepticism. But I think that if they saw the information, they might take a little bit more time on the peer review.
We did not disclose it. Ethical concerns. Whether they do now or not, I don't know.
We're out of time.
Stimulating set of interactions. I appreciate the contributions of our panelists. So thank you for moderating.